Welcome on into the 8 o'clock hour. It's Chris Thomas tonight, Turtle, with you until 10 o'clock. Man, there's a lot going on between the Cowboys and the Falcons. Now we got the McGarry saga. Storm Norton's out. Who's going to play? Now, Oren, here's the question. Is Elijah Wilkinson going to play tomorrow now? Who's going to play tackle?
He needs the work.
I mean, I guess, right? But you can't afford him getting hurt now. Brandon Parker, I think, is the next guy up on the depth chart. I mean,
well, Brandon was the guy who sucked at left tackle. Or was, let me rephrase that. Wasn't playing well at left tackle.
No, he sucked.
That's why they moved. So they moved Elijah out there to play because Brandon Coleman wasn't doing well. So
he sucked. But he's like 6'9", 350.
He's a giant.
He's a huge guy. We'll see who plays and who doesn't. And to get a inside perspective on the WadeFord.com hotline, we welcome in Bobby Belt of 105.3, the Fan in Dallas. And, yeah, who's going to play? Who's not? Are there any names we're going to know out there?
No, he'll play some people. It'll just be the people that he's playing. They'll have name recognition. It's just, are they going to be starters? Not necessarily. But, I mean, you'll know Joe Milton. You'll know some of the other people that pop out there, I would assume. But, yeah, you're not – in terms of Dak Prescott, CeeDee Lamb, definitely Micah Parsons, those are not individuals you'll see in this game. But I would imagine he's going to try to give some reps to some of the guys he plans on being starters this year. A lot of the offensive line, I would imagine, will play. I think they're still trying to figure out their secondary, so they'll have some different guys there that will play. But, yeah, in large part, they've taken a – very conservative approach to the preseason and how they play their starters. This is not going to be, you know, Cincinnati versus Washington with Burrow versus Daniels.
As has Raheem Morris, he has already said that this game is purely meant for roster decision purposes. So the Falcons are not planning to play either their first round picks in Jalen Walker or James Pierce Jr., along with a host of others, including QB1 and QB2 and Michael Penix Jr. and Kirk Cousins. You mentioned some of the battles at safety and offensive line. How was the roster viewed going into this preseason and training camp, Bobby? How many holes were there for the Cowboys?
Man, there were plenty heading into the offseason, and I think people felt like free agency didn't do much to address it. But then, of course, they make the trade for George Pickens. They try to solidify the backup quarterback position by making a trade for Joe Milton. The draft, I think everybody felt like, was a real home run. You got Tyler Booker to play guard for you. Okay, that is a pro-ready plug-and-play guard. You then go out and get Donovan Ezeraku from Boston College, who is a pro-ready, you know, pass rush skill set, even if, you know, the complete game isn't there yet. Savona Ravel, who they got in the third round, the cornerback. That looked to be like, hey, that's a really nice way to complement your corner room. Now you've got him and Diggs and Bland. Well, then you get into training camp and everything looks different. So Ravel has a setback from recovering from an ACL injury, so he still isn't ready to go. Diggs in the corner room has had his trouble getting ready to go, so that has complicated things. Donovan Ezeraku has looked good in these training camp practices, but when he gets into these games, he has not had the same sort of pass rush success, which we frequently see from edge rushers. A lot of them don't have a lot of first-year success. And then Tyler Booker didn't get into the first game, and then he got into the second and played well. But, I mean, I think there's still a question about how cohesive that unit is right now. So I think a lot of people looked at it really optimistically in terms of what they had put together and thought, you know what, we're buying into the Brian Schottenheimer culture talk. The roster construction is looking better. They're investing more in bringing people in from the outside than they have in recent years. And so I think a lot of people probably enter training camp thinking, 10-win football team, maybe 9-10-win football team. And I think as training camp has gone along and you've seen they have serious questions about their depth, then it's kind of adjusted back down maybe to 7-8 wins. That's the kind of football team I think we're looking at, depending on how good the offensive line is. That's what's really going to determine things for Dallas, is how good is that offensive line? How far are the steps that they take forward? Some of the guys like Tyler Guyton and Cooper Beebe, if they do take significant steps forward, going to be really tough to stop this offense. If they don't, then I don't know that the offense is good enough to overcome some of the holes they're going to have on defense.
There was sort of a collective jaw drop when Brian Schottenheimer was hired in Dallas. Has the calm, the storm after the calm, so to speak, has that died down in Dallas? Are you guys still raging about him and the potential for the negative there, or are you guys buying into what you've seen so far from him?
Yeah, so if the changeover, the shock from the changeover is something that people are really intrigued by, I'm the wrong guy to ask because I thought their last head coach was just not very good at all. And I thought it was well past time for him to go. And Brian Schottenheimer, on the other hand, strikes me as – Schottenheimer is the politician who's been running for president his whole life, where it's like, man, he's done all these different things and he's checked all these boxes, you know, taken all these different positions within government. And when he runs, you maybe feel like, man, has this guy just been working for this his whole life? Like, how good is he really if he hasn't gotten this job yet? But you do have the sense of, like, the one thing I know is he's not going to be surprised by anything. He's not going to be caught off guard. He's a football lifer. His dad, Marty Schottenheimer, obviously was a, you know, legendary coach who was around for a number of years. Brian has been in a number of different systems, has been in a number of dysfunctional organizations from the Jets to the Jaguars to whoever. And so I don't think there's anything that's really going to surprise him about the Dallas job. And what you do know is that he is a very effective communicator, and he's somebody who really loves the game of football and loves explaining it. So my sense of it back in January was when they hired him was, as unhappy as people are right now, by the time week one rolls around, Brian Schottenheimer is going to have sky-high approval ratings with fans. And that's exactly what's happened. Now, as soon as they start losing games, that'll flip. If they go 0-3 to start the season, people will turn on it really fast. But he's won over a lot of people with the kinds of things he's trying to implement, the kinds of things he talks about. Like I said, very effective communicator and somebody who has won over a number of the different legends in the organization. So, like, Michael Irvin's a great example of that. Irvin was very critical of the hire. He got a chance to visit the team this offseason and saw a lot of things that he, by his own word, felt like were similar to the things that Jimmy Johnson tried to do with them, that he felt like, okay, this organization is doing the right thing and there's real accountability here and there's real change that can happen here. So there's a lot of former players who have gone through the building now this offseason and feel like Schottenheimer was the right hire.
So I know how much we've talked about Dak Prescott, and we're in Atlanta, so I can't even imagine what it's like on a day-to-day basis. Is the consensus between media and fans alike that he can be a Super Bowl winning quarterback?
Man, I think it's probably similar to the consensus that exists in Atlanta or nationally. There are a lot of people who think Dak Prescott is on his best day as a top five quarterback, and there are a lot of people who think he is a glorified bus driver and you have grossly overpaid and overrated quarterback. I fall into the camp that thinks he can do it. And I think that a big part of it is, again, what goes into being the quarterback of the Dallas Cowboys and the attention that comes with that and the mental makeup that comes with that. And I think that he's uniquely equipped to handle that. That's why I really do believe in the combo of Schottenheimer and Dak as the coach quarterback combo for everything that comes with this job and everything that comes with this football team. But I think just in the skill standpoint and a processing and IQ standpoint, I do think Dak is one of the better quarterbacks in the NFL. He's not the best. He's not top three, but to me, he's comfortably in the top 10. And when you factor in those other intangibles, that makes him a really solid option at the quarterback position. So Daniel Jeremiah has always called it the confetti test. Can you envision that person standing in raining confetti holding a Super Bowl trophy? And for me, at least, I think he passes that test. I just think that Dak Prescott is probably the most polarizing quarterback in the NFL, this side of a guy who's your backup now in Kirk Cousins.
Yeah. Well, don't get me started on that. we're talking with Bobby Belt of our sister station, 105.3, The Fan in Dallas. All right, I've made it 8.5 minutes, Bobby, and I haven't mentioned Micah Parsons. Do I get a gold star?
And congratulations.
To the best of your knowledge, just what's going on, man?
You know, it's really hard to say because I think nationally everybody keeps saying, oh, it's the same old Cowboys negotiating tactics, and it's really easy to default to that. Okay, they did this with, go back to DeMarcus Lawrence. Then it was Ezekiel Elliott. Then they did it with Dak Prescott the first time. Then they did it with Dak Prescott the second time. They did it with CeeDee Lamb. They've done it with Zach Martin holding out. So they've done this a number of different ways. This is the first time that it's gotten as personal from the Cowboys side, I feel like, where they feel like they had a handshake deal, it wasn't honored, and they're upset about it. And from Micah's side, I think they feel like there was no handshake deal, you misinterpreted that. Totally understand from your perspective if you think that was the case, and I understand how you then feel betrayed by that, but I'm telling you that wasn't the case. So, like, I think that's what they've tried to communicate. But that's a difficult thing. Players have frequently got their feelings hurt in negotiations with the Cowboys because it's one of their negotiating tactics. And then ultimately they pay through the nose and it doesn't matter very much. But like I said, this is the first time it feels like an equal offense from the Cowboys side where they feel like they've been wronged. And so, look, they've said they're not going to trade him despite his request. A lot of people feel like the request is just a negotiating tactic. I think they're serious about it. Now, that doesn't mean you can't smooth over it. And if the Cowboys extend an olive branch and make it right that it can't be smoothed over, that all could happen. The problem is I don't know how motivated this time the Cowboys are to do that because of how upset they are by how the negotiations have gone. So my guess is 40% chance a deal gets done before the season starts. If the season starts, I think Micah shows up. I think Micah plays on the fifth-year option. But if he plays on the fifth-year option, I would put it north of 80% that the Cowboys trade him next spring.
How much do you think it would mean for Jerry Jones to win another Super Bowl versus keeping his name, his team, and his valuation skyrocketing as it does year in and year out without the hardware?
So I think there's a little bit of a misconception about Jerry. And I think the America's Team documentary that's on Netflix right now that just dropped yesterday, I think it's a great representation for anybody who wants to understand how Jerry thinks, not sympathize with him or anything else, but just understand how he came to think the way he does about football decisions. I think the documentary does a great job of explaining that. I think that he wants to win another Super Bowl as badly as anything else in the world. The problem is there's a caveat there. If you told him, Jerry, you can be the owner and I will guarantee you a Super Bowl, I'll give you this extra one, but you have to give over all control and you're just the owner and you're not the general manager, not involved in any football decisions, but I guarantee you that Super Bowl, I think he would say no. But under the standard of, hey, I'm one who builds consensus and I put experts in place to act as a brain trust and make decisions and consult with me, and then I will basically just use a veto pen when I don't agree, but I don't frequently use it. I think that that's his operation in terms of how he leads as an executive now, which I don't think is necessarily a flawed way to do it at this stage of his career. But I think that that's the thing, is that he wants so badly to be remembered as a football guy, quote unquote. And I think a lot of people wondered if the Hall of Fame jacket was going to do that for him, and it hasn't. And I think he just desperately wants to win one more. For one, just because he's ultra competitive and he wants to win, I think he does want those things. But I think another aspect of that is just he wants to be remembered as somebody who did it his way.
Before I let you go, how high is the mountain to climb even within your own division?
Well, I mean, the history would tell us that, you know, somebody else other than the Eagles is going to win it this year in the division, because that's, we're on 21 years in a row now, 22 years in a row where they haven't had a back-to-back division champion. The last time was, I think, the 04 season when the Eagles won it. I would pick the Eagles if I was, you know, in the business of, you know, betting odds and things like that. I would pick the Eagles to win the division. I would pick Washington to finish second. I think Dallas is going to be around where the Giants are. And that's a negative for the Cowboys. It's also probably a positive for the Giants in terms of where those two teams are at right now. But yeah, Dallas, no doubt about it, has some flaws. I think the offense is going to be pretty good. I don't know that they're going to be able to stop teams from scoring 30 points on them every week. And that's a concern. They just don't have a lot of depth. Matt Eberflus is here as the defensive coordinator this year, and he's trying to put in a scheme similar to the one Rod Marinelli had run previously. And that's just so wildly different from what they had done under Dan Quinn and then even last year under Mike Zimmer that I don't know if they've got the personnel to make that work. And you can't just change that personnel instantly overnight. That takes a year or two to kind of get the people that you need to fit that. And so I think it's going to be a season where Dallas probably 7-10. Heading into training camp, I would have said 9-8, 10-7. But the more you watch them and you kind of see some of the serious depth issues, I think this is probably a 7 or 8-win football team.
All right, Bobby, appreciate the time. As always, we'll be checking you out on The Fan, and we'll chat soon.
Appreciate it.
All right, that is Bobby Belt there of our sister station in Dallas. All right, when we get back, let's keep the conversation going. Braves underway right now. Final game. That was Bobby Belt there of 105.3 The Fan in Dallas. Chris Thomas tonight, Turtle, with you until 10 o'clock. When we get back, let's talk some college football. Huge news in the SEC today as they will move to a 9-game conference schedule. Our buddy Matt Mershell of the Orlando Sentinel, College Football Insider, will join me next to break it all down. 9 games for the SEC when we get back. It's Chris Thomas tonight. So, did the SEC cave, or are they just getting with the times? As it was announced today that starting next season, 9-game conference schedule. To break that down and talk all things college football, one of our favorite college football guests, Matt Mershell of the Orlando Sentinel. Make sure you check out his work there covering all things college football. Matt, let's start there. 9 games next season for the SEC. What do you think was the impetus behind this?
I think part of this was the changes to the college football playoff, impending changes. You know, what are they going to move forward with? You know, it's going to be, you know, are they going to go to 16? Is there a possibility they could go, you know, 24, 28? You know, the college football playoff committee, management committee talked about this the other day about, you know, changing some of their, you know, some of their requirements that pertains to, you know, scheduling and strength of schedule and things like that. And I think, you know, the SEC has been kind of sitting on this issue for a while now. It's been a long time. They've debated this back and forth, whether or not they thought 9 games was the way to go or sticking with an 8. I think at this point, they just realized it's better to kind of go with 9. You know, the Big 12, the Big 10 are at 9 at this point. The ACC is looking at going to 9. The idea is just, let's just go ahead and make this move. And you know, again, you know, they're not going to go with divisions. Each school is going to play 3 annual opponents. The traditional rivalries are going to be there as well. So I think all those things kind of set well for the SEC. I think it's one of the reasons why they decided, you know, to go with this now and kind of move forward on that as they decide to move forward with the college football playoff.
You don't think anything had to do with some of the remarks of the offseason and coaches and conferences sort of calling out the SEC? Do you feel like this was maybe a move that the conference decided to make to get in line with the other conferences, or is that just a non-factor? That sort of noise wouldn't make sense to have any effect on an announcement this size.
No, I don't think any of that. I know Greg Sankey a little bit, and I don't think Greg would let any, you know, whatever other conferences or conference commissioners or coaches or whatever we're saying about, you know, the SEC not being at 9. I mean, listen, I think they've been talking about this, like I mentioned, for a while now, and I think they've been. You know, I think they sat down and just said, let's really seriously talk about what this is going to do. And I think based on the new parameters with the playoff, I think they realized, okay, well, this is something now that, you know, this is going to provide a lot of strength for, you know, for its league. You know, I think they're looking at this idea of, okay, now we're a stronger league. And let's look at our schedule. I mean, we play 9. The SEC is one of the toughest conferences in the country. We're going to play 9 games now. You know, I think that's a huge part of that. And I think that's something that's helped them out to make this decision. And, you know, I mean, it was bound to happen. I just think whether it was going to happen next year, whether it was going to happen, you know, 2 years down the road, I think eventually it just came down to looking at the college football playoff and deciding what's best for this conference moving forward to continue to make it one of the best conferences in the country.
So, in my opinion, a team – I'll use this as an example. I think a team that would get impacted the most if this were next year, let's say, would be a team like South Carolina, who is potentially on a playoff watch bubble, but if they had a 9th tough opponent in conference and they lose that game, could that potentially keep them out of a playoff? I don't know if you agree with me, Matt, but I don't think like the Georgias and the Texases of the world, this is going to really impact them much. It would be a team like a South Carolina.
Yeah, and again, it depends on how the scheduling works. You know, I mean, because you know, like the SEC is like a lot of conferences. You know, there are teams at the bottom of their conference, you know, that aren't necessarily as strong. So maybe your 9th, 1 year, your 9th team is not going to be an Alabama or a Texas or a Texas A&M. Maybe it's going to be a Vanderbilt. You know, maybe it's going to be a conference, a team that's at the bottom, and it actually benefits you in some ways because you're playing, you know, a less stronger opponent, but it's still an SEC opponent. You know, so I think those are going to be times like that. Other times it's going to be difficult. Other times you're going to have a top ranked team that's going to be that 9th team that's going to come in there, and it's going to, you know, it could be a tough decision to have to play those, you know, those teams, but. Again, that's, you know, they've talked about this before. You know, when you play in the SEC, that's just kind of the way it is. You know, now whether or not you know, this league will expand at some point, you know, when the television deals are up, you know, in a few years, you know, that's another aspect of all this. But, you know, I know the SEC has really wanted to do something like this for a while. They've just talked about it. Coaches have hemmed and hawed about it. But I think this is going to end up being the right move. And I think in the long run, you know, when it gets said and done, I think, you know, most coaches will want the opportunity to play someone in their own league rather than maybe playing a group of five school or, you know, a FCS school. I mean, don't get me wrong. I think SEC schools will still do that in their scheduling. But now you're down to maybe, you know, you're playing 10, you know, power four schools. So you're showcasing yourself that you are one of the strongest conferences in the country.
Well, to your point, Matt, the SEC official conference Twitter page literally put hashtag it just means more in the announcement for the expansion of SEC play to 9 games. So you are spot on the money there. All right, around the college football landscape we go. What do you make of this weird story out of Texas where Arch Manning has to scold his grandpa Archie about saying with too much confidence that he knows about the future of his grandson?
Well, I mean, that's not what Arch Manning wants to have happen. You know, I'm sure he's going into the season focused on trying to, you know, lead Texas. This is his chance now. He's finally going to be the starter outright. And what happens is all of a sudden someone in your family, your grandfather Archie Manning steps out and talks about, you know, you already decided you're moving on to the NFL after this year. I mean, I just think that's just a distraction you hate to have happen because, again, you know, you want to go in there extremely focused. You don't want people to be asking you every week in and week out, are you going to the NFL? What's going to happen? You know, what's your plans for the future? What's going on? I mean, goodness, we haven't even played our first game yet, you know, the season. I mean, you know, to be able to think that way, I think there's a little bit looking past there. I mean, listen, I think Arch Manning's has some talent there, but we haven't even seen a full season out of them. So I'm sure there are some NFL scouts who are like, let's pump the brakes on that. You know, we got to at least see what he's like, you know, out there. Can he lead a team to, you know, and it's going to be a challenge for Arch. Listen, to be the quarterback of the number one team in the country starting the season, there are going to be challenges there. And if they can go through the whole season as the number one team, that's a pretty incredible accomplishment. If he stays healthy and is the quarterback, it's one of those things that very rarely happens. So there'll be some challenges there. So having your grandfather step up and make that statement, I'm sure didn't help things. And again, you hear that he apologized and everything, but I'm sure for Arch, it's much more focused about, you know, getting that week one game against Ohio State, focused on trying to take this team game by game instead of focusing on what's going to happen next year.
Speaking of distractions, what did you make of that proposal by the Big Ten?
I think, I get it. I understand that there's some like, oh, this will be great. Let's do 24-28. You know, the FCS playoff is a large amount of teams. My thing was initially is you guys can't get on 16 yet. I mean, they haven't even decided on of possibly expanding to 16 teams. They have too much trouble on that front. I mean, why are we talking about 24-28? I mean, it's to me, it's like, why don't you try to just maybe get to that the next step, you know, before trying to jump three or four steps, because normally what happens is you're going to fall when that happens. So I think that's something they're going to have to take a look at and see. Maybe if they go to 16 and they do it for a few years, maybe then they can get everything kind of sorted out how they want to do 24 or 28. I think it's sort of just a pie in the sky type thought by the Big Ten to say, listen, this would be great if we did this. Think of all these teams that you get in there. I think one thing it's going to really kind of hold that down or keep that from happening is what about the bowl schedule? You know, bowl games are very popular. You know, people like watching bowl games. It's ESPN, you know, that's what fills ESPN's airtime during the month of December is bowl games. And if you go to 24-28 playoff, you're going to lose a bunch of bowl games. That means, you know, those are opportunities that, you know, in some cases that teams won't be able to have. And so I'm not sure if that's something they're going to be able to do. Plus, you have to get through financing. We haven't even gotten through a full year of revenue share. I mean, those are things that, you know, you have to kind of still kind of go through and figure out how that's working well. So I'm of the belief that that's just a pie in the sky type of philosophy. Maybe just focus on getting to maybe that 16-team playoff and getting that set up before we start talking about 24 or 28.
What do you make of this weekend's matchup with Kansas State and Iowa State overseas. And do you like that format that we've done the last couple of years of starting the season abroad?
Yeah, I think it's going to be huge. I mean, this is the kind of game you want on a week zero game. You know, this game actually matters on several levels. It matters in the Big 12. Both these two teams are considered, you know, one of the top teams in the conference. You know, they're meeting head to head. This gets an opportunity. Whoever wins this game is going to have at least an early leg up on the Big 12, you know, title race. You know, whether it's Iowa State, which has won, I think, four of the last five meetings, you know, I think they want an opportunity. Obviously, Kansas State is going to be a top program. They're trying to go for it. It also has implications for the college football playoff. I mean, both these two teams are expected to be in the top 25. They're in the top 25 starting the season. So, I mean, you know, you're looking at this idea of, you know, whoever loses this game, you know, might fall out of the rankings. It might hurt their chances. This is a big opportunity on the quarterback scene. You know, you look at the quarterback situation with Rocco Beck at Iowa State and Anthony Johnson at, you know, Kansas State. I think it's going to be a heck of a matchup of those two. So I'm looking forward to this weekend. I think the Farmageddon is definitely the game that's high on my list of games to watch this weekend.
More pressure on Texas than Ohio State to win?
Yes. That's a good question, because I would say yes, because Texas being the number one team, having been there before, it's tough. But I also think Ohio State comes in with this idea of, you know, you're the defending national champion, you know, and I think people are expecting you to come out there and perform. If you lose to Texas, in a way, you know, I think Ohio State could say, okay, they're the number one team in the country. You know, we went through a bunch of changes. Everything's, it's going to take us a bit to get back to where we're at. You know, if you're Texas and you lose, all of a sudden people start pointing the finger and saying, okay, maybe you weren't as good as everyone thought you are. You know, maybe Arch Manning isn't as good as we think he is. And then the pressure really starts to mount a little bit for Texas. So I think Texas, this game is really, you know, I think for them, the pressure is going to be on. And it's a big test for Steve Sarkisian, the head coach. You know, they really haven't had this kind of opportunity since he's been there. And I think now they get a chance to do that. And if they can prove themselves and go into Ohio State and win that game, I think it's huge for them. I think it puts them on a great footing momentum-wise moving forward. And I think it's what they exactly like to have to get into the season.
How big would another week one loss be for Brian Kelly?
Oh, that would, I think, you know, I've said this over the last couple months that I think if they don't have a successful season, and by successful season, I mean, not just go to a bowl game. I mean, they've got to probably get into the college football playoff. If that doesn't happen, I got to wonder how long is he going to be coached there? Because they spent a lot of money to bring Brian Kelly in and it wasn't just to go and play the average bowl game. They want, you know, they want an SEC title. They want to get a chance to play in the college football playoff. They want to compete for the national championship. If they were to lose in the week one, I think there would be so much drumbeat for the idea that of possibly, you know, making a change. They've invested so much money in them, though, and I'm not sure if they could make a change. But I think there would be a lot of unhappy LSU fans because, again, you were brought in to win games. That's the reason why they took you away from Notre Dame, was to come to LSU and turn things around. And if you can't do that, you can't get that to that big game, it's going to always be a fault for you. He wasn't able to do it at Notre Dame. He didn't win a national title at Notre Dame. So at LSU, they've got maybe some better athletes there, but is he ever going to get over that hump and try to get to the title game and win it?
Before I let you go, speaking of Notre Dame, any surprise about Carr getting the starting job?
No, I think, you know, I think Marcus Freeman was pretty, you know, wanted to have a competition, was able to kind of get through that, especially in today's day and age of the transfer portal. You know, you want to make sure you keep both guys there. I'm interested in Carr at quarterback. I'm interested in Notre Dame. I think it's interesting, you know, they've had last 2 years, you know, they've relied heavily on the transfer portal. They brought in experienced quarterbacks who they felt like could get them to that next level. Now they're going with a little younger guy, and it's going to be a challenge to see, can this guy, you know, can they run the offense? Can they go out there and have success and win and develop a quarterback, you know, and go from there? I think a lot of teams, you know, are so enamored with the idea of going out and bringing in a veteran, you know, to lead their teams to the college football playoff. But in some ways, some of these teams have to start developing quarterbacks. I mean, it's just part of nature. And I mean, you know, that's the way the system is. So it'll be interesting to see what happens at Notre Dame.
Matt, appreciate the time. As always, we'll check in soon and enjoy this game starting this weekend.
All right, thanks a lot. Take care.
All right, that is Matt Mershell. Check him out in the Orlando Sentinel College Football Insider. When we get back, what did Raheem Morris have to say about the offensive line depth and his coaching philosophy in the preseason? You'll hear that and more coming up. It's an NFL soundcheck to close out the 8 o'clock hour coming up next. We continue to wait and wait and wait for a real update on Caleb McGarry. We got a facsimile of an update earlier today from Jeremy Fowler that said basically, yeah, he's hurt, but he's going to miss some time. Thanks, Jer. Appreciate you. 404-726-0929. Going to get into a NFL sound check right here and then a producer six pack. Haven't done one of those all week, so we'll have that ready to go at the top of the hour. Raheem Morris was asked, I think, a question that we've all been wondering here about that preseason philosophy. Coach, why do you do the things that you do?
And it's not just necessarily starters you're playing. It's just like significant people on the team that I don't need to see things from in that setting. And really, for me, it's about mitigating injury.
Okay, but did you mitigate injury in practice yesterday with Mr. McGarry? Oren, what did Ovi Mihaly tell us about the preseason a couple hours ago? He says it is a crime, a travesty, that there is no more preseason play for starters in the majority of the cases. He said back in the day, those were valuable reps, man.
Yeah, you go out there and that's why that third preseason game was the most important preseason game, because that's the one you treated as the dress rehearsal for week one. It wasn't so much about what you did on the field, but it was like the game planning beforehand that went into it. Like, you treated that week like an actual game week.
And guess what, guys? If you can believe this in the Wayback Machine, the starters would play like a half, sometimes even more, if the coach didn't like what they saw. What a crazy idea that is, huh? Raheem Morris was also talking about the depth of the offensive line. Pretty relevant now, huh?
I've been really pleased with the depth of the offensive line since I've been here, just in general. You know, not a lot of places you can go and you feel good about a two deep, let alone a two deep plus, as far as the offensive line. We've got people that play significant snaps for us.
Oren, I have a question. What was he watching? Because I didn't come away with that takeaway.
I am not sure what he saw beforehand.
I mean, I obviously I wasn't there at Flowery Branch this year because I was doing this here radio show. But the last couple of years I was up at Flowery Branch, and when I was producing Dukes and Bell, and I'll tell you what, it's pretty easy to see who's good and who ain't. And the backup offensive line did not look good in either preseason game. So I guess that's just Raheem doing what he needs to do to pump up his guys. One more from Coach, and then we'll do a little whip around of the National Football League. Again, this is an NFL soundcheck on Chris Thomas tonight. He says there's still a lot of position battles that need to play out, and we'll see those on Friday.
There's still so much to be done. What are you talking about, today's practice? Or are you talking about a jog through? Or are you talking about even the preseason game that we got to play at the end on what those position battles entail? And, like, you just never know what's going to happen in every single day.
I mean, yeah. I would say corner, nickel, safety, defensive line rotation, obviously now right tackle. There's a bunch of stuff that still needs to be sorted out. Wide receiver, the depth there. So, yeah, Coach is right. He's got a lot on his hands before roster cutdown day becomes next week, which will be here before we know it. All right, let's whip around the National Football League. Ooh, this is interesting. The Colts QB coach, his name is Cam Turner. He spoke out on Anthony Richardson and losing the battle to Daniel Jones.
As a position coach, you know, you want to see your guys succeed and be successful naturally. And, you know, I feel like I've tried everything I can do, you know, and I feel like he's given great effort in that aspect too. And I don't think either way it's one or the other. I just think, you know, right now it's not where the consistency is just not where we wanted it to be.
That's a pretty damning take, I would think, from Coach Cam Turner there. He was pretty blunt, just like, dude's not doing it right now. And clearly that is the case. Oren, we said it yesterday. It's worth repeating today. When you lose the starting battle to Daniel Jones, I was about to say no offense to Daniel Jones, but it's kind of offense.
That's perfectly offensive towards Daniel Jones,
towards Daniel Jones.
All offense to Daniel Jones.
That is not where you want to be in your career. Joe Flacco isn't a place he wants to be in his career. That's winning the starting job in Cleveland. But he says, listen, it's just business as usual.
It's just business as usual. Go out there and, you know, get another good practice in, get some reps with the guys, and, you know, kind of continue to work towards what we've been all training camp. So,
when did you kind of know that you were going to get named the starter?
When Kevin told me. I mean, I don't know. You know, you keep your head down and you just try to do your best, and felt like I was having a good camp with the reps that I was given, and that's all you can do.
Yeah, he was like, man, look at these scrubs. Kenny Pickett, bum. Dylan Gabriel, bum. Deshaun Watson, bum. Shadur, bum. Oh, wait a minute. Oh, he got injured, bum. So he was kind of the last man standing there. So much so, they had to bring in, who was it, Snoop Huntley as a roster depth piece?
Yeah, just to get through the week, yeah.
Yeah, because so many of their quarterbacks got hurt. But, I mean, listen, they're not going to be any good. Justin Fields, I don't think the Jets are going to be very good either. He's being criticized for, Oren, something we've known about him. He is struggling throwing the ball. And he says, have no fear. We're okay with methodically working the ball down the field.
We're fine with taking the 8-10-yard completion and taking time off the clocks, driving down the field and having, you know, 10, 15-play drives. You know, that gets the defense tired, and, you know, it might not be as exciting on the offensive, you know, side of the ball for the fans. But, like I said, it's efficient ball.
Ew, what a gross statement that was from Justin Fields. Like, dude, you're like a top 2% athlete in the world, and you're talking about matriculating the ball down the field. Justin, where's your legs? Justin, where's that cannon of an arm that you have? You just can't get the ball to your receivers, huh, guy? I mean, I guess that's the problem. We shall see what type of offense they have. Interesting here, Myles Garrett spoke out. Oren, if you remember, I think it was last week or maybe earlier this week. He was doing 100 miles an hour in a 60, got clocked, and he was asked about it.
I'd honestly rather talk about football on this team than anything I'm doing off field other than the back to school, you know, event that I did the other day.
But still, I mean, people want to know about that.
People want to know a lot of things.
Okay. You think the team got in his ear, Oren, and said, don't talk about it? Or did he make that decision on his own? I don't know. All right, before we get out of here, this is from the world of the bizarre. Eric Dickerson, legendary NFL player himself, says that the league told teams not to draft Shadur Sanders. What?
And I'll tell you this much here, what I heard from someone that's in the NFL, that the NFL told other, don't draft him, do not draft him. We're gonna make an example out of him. And this came from a very good source. And he said that, I won't say who, somebody called the Cleveland Browns and said, don't do that. Draft
really?
Him. Yep, draft him. Don't do that. Because they weren't gonna draft him either. They weren't gonna draft him.
What? So Shadur Sanders got blackballed by the NFL? Oren, don't you think we would have heard of this before now if that was the case?
Yeah, that would have come out. I mean, I'm pretty sure we would have heard about that.
If his camp felt like he was being blackballed by the league, I would have thought that he would have been, you know, that would have been the lead on every single NFL show for 6 weeks. But Eric Dickerson, like, he's not somebody, to my knowledge, right? Do you know of him as somebody to come out and just rattle cages for no reason? I don't really think so. So what's tea here? What's going on? Is there a plot by the NFL to keep Shadur Sanders out of the league? That's going to be interesting if Pablo Torre maybe finds out. If you don't know, are you familiar with that podcast, Oren? Very good.
It's like he's like the Yahoo Sports, what the investigators used to be back in the day. That's what Pablo Torre is now, yeah.
So he does. He was the one who cracked the Bill Belichick story about his girlfriend. So maybe he'll do a deep dive into this and find out what's going on. As we close out here, something a little fun. ESPN did an article ranking every team in the NFL and how much fun they're going to be to watch. Oren, if you had to ballpark a guess, where do you think the Atlanta Falcons came in?
I would say I'm gonna give them as much benefit of the doubt as possible, and I'm going to say 12th or 13th.
Ye of little faith.
Top 10?
How about 6?
Okay.
And here's their reasoning. If you didn't catch a full Falcons game last season, you weren't living right.
Oh, my gosh.
In September, they had the following four-game stretch, beating the eventual Super Bowl champion Eagles on a two-minute drill, losing to the eventual AFC champion Chiefs by one score after two consecutive zone drives ended with turnovers on downs, beating division rival Saints on a game-winning field goal after surrendering the lead with 1 minute remaining, and then, of course, we know beating the Bucks behind a 500-yard performance from Kirk Cousins. That was back-to-back-to-back-to-back games. And now, with Michael Penix Jr. at the helm, things should get a little wilder,
yeah, huh?
Be even more crazy. All right, good stuff.
Well, all right.
Yeah, good stuff there on an NFL sound check. When we get back, we'll do something we haven't done all week. We will mix in a producer six-pack that is four sports questions of any kind from Oren Romain, and then two anything-goes questions. Can be lifestyle, entertainment, movies, food, music, you name it. It is all on the table. We'll do that to kick off a busy, busy fourth and final hour here. It is Chris Thomas tonight coming at you from the Kia Studios live every single weeknight, 6 to 10 on Sports Radio 92.9 The Game. And take us with you anytime, anywhere on the free Odyssey app.